All right, everyone, welcome back to the podcast. Today, we're diving into the mind of someone extra special. We're diving into the mind of Sue Black. Now, Sue Black is a leading forensic anthropologist. She's identified war crime victims, unearthed hidden stories in our bones, and also pioneered a new technique that they currently use in the court of law. This technique identifies people. It gives them kind of a fingerprint from the veins on their hands, which is just wild. Sue is now president of St. John's College in Oxford. And I do need to tell you before we start this podcast, we do touch on some very, very sensitive subjects. But without further ado, let's just get straight in to this episode of the Infinite Podcast. I have kind of a timeline set up for you and fascinating stuff. I mean, identifying victims or identifying criminals through the vein structure. I mean, I'm definitely not using the right terminology here, but oh my God, fascinating. Take me back to where it started for you.
Sure. So in terms of the casework associated with that feature you're talking about, that came in around in 2006. And the Metropolitan Police got in touch with me to say, look, we've got a case and we really don't know what to do with it. Can you have a look at it for us? And so forensic anthropology and anatomy, which is what I am, we're often the scrapings at the bottom of the barrel. You know, when you can't go anywhere else, we'll go and ask them. And what it was is they had a video, and it was a video that was taken at night on a computer. And what was alleged to be happening was that the father was coming into the daughter's bedroom. Daughter was a young teenager, and sexually abusing her.
Oh my God.
And she talked to her mum, and her mum didn't believe her. And so what she did was she turned on her camera on her computer and left it running at night. Most people don't know, when you do that, your camera goes into near infrared mode. And so what you can see is you can see in the dark. And it's a very black and white, grayed black and white image. You don't get color and you don't get a lot of detail. But at 4:30 in the morning, what we did see was a hand and a forearm coming into the view of her camera and doing exactly what she said was happening to her. Now, you know, just thinking about that, this is a teenage girl who was saying that she was being sexually abused by her father. She has a mother who she's gone to who doesn't believe her. And she has the presence of mind to put her camera on so that it's recorded. She knows she's going to be abused again, and she's going to record it because she wants the evidence and the proof that this is happening to her. Now, I don't know whether there were other children in the family. That's not something I know. So maybe she was doing it to protect them, or maybe she was doing it just because she herself wanted it to stop. But there's a presence of mind in there and a bravery, I think, for a young teenage girl. So when you view the human body through near infrared mode, the light, as it interacts with your skin, it actually interacts with the deoxygenated blood that's in your veins, and your veins stand out like black tram lines. So you can see them beautifully. So we could see a beautiful vein pattern on the hand and on the forearm. And what I said to the police is, now, I don't know what that means, but what I can do is I can take the pattern on the offender's veins and I can take the pattern on the suspect veins, which is dad, and I can tell you if they match or not. If they don't match, then it can't possibly be him because you don't change your vein pattern. But if they do match, I don't know what that means because we've not done the research. But if they don't match, at least we could exclude dad. And the police said, go for it. Do the comparison. At least if we can rule dad out, that's a step forward.
Yeah.
So when we did the comparison, of course, they matched perfectly. And I don't know what that means because this wasn't my area of research. I'm talking as an anatomist. And we know in anatomy that when you're looking at the distal end of the limb, the first vein that we know is going to occur is the one that's in your in the elbow.
That's the one that kind of pops out that you take blood from.
That's right. And that's why they do it, because they know it's going to be there.
Right.
Because that's one that's consistent. All the other veins, the further away you are from the heart, the more variable your vein pattern is. And if you doubt me, look at the pattern of veins on the back of your right hand, compare it to the pattern of veins on the back of your left hand. They won't match. And we know that. And we've known that since the 1500s. When Vesalius was looking at anatomy, he didn't name those veins because they were never the same in any two people. So we know they're variable. We knew that in the biometrics industry and security industry, people were starting to use vein patterns as a means of gaining access to high security installations, because we know that it's a really useful means of determining whether two sets of images come from the same person. So we had the background in anatomy, we had the background in biometrics. We could tell that we can't exclude dad, but I don't know what else that means. So it goes to the Crown Prosecution Service and they're building the case and they decide, no, we're going to see if we can get this evidence into the courtroom. So this evidence has never been heard before in a UK court. And what the judge does, quite rightly, is he calls something that's called a voir dire. And the voir dire means, hold on a minute, I need to decide whether this new evidence you're bringing is legitimate science or whether it's witchcraft, quite frankly. And so the jury gets sent out of the courtroom and we have the discussion. And the judge was convinced that because of the history of anatomy and variation and the results that we're getting from the biometrics industry, providing we did not overstep where that research was at the time, he was prepared to let it be heard in the court. And so I was allowed to give evidence. The jury then retire and they come back in and they come back in with a verdict of not guilty. And that really sort of stops me in my tracks thinking, you know, who else is in this girl's room at 4:30 in the morning with an identical vein pattern? And so I said to the barrister, what did I do wrong? Because that's the first thing you do. You blame yourself. And she said to me something that will never, ever leave me. She said, no, you did nothing wrong. There was no problem with your evidence. They didn't believe the girl. She didn't break down and she didn't cry. And I thought, dear Lord, you know, justice is not about whether a child breaks down and cries. This was a girl who was strong enough to accuse her father, tell her mother about it. And even when her mother refused to believe her, she recorded it and she took it to the police. That to me is the most outstanding bravery in a teenager. And the jury decided not to believe her because she didn't cry. The outcome of that, of course, I will never know, because once you're finished in court, you're finished. But he was released, found not guilty, and therefore would be back in the family home. What happened to that girl? You know, did he carry on the abuse, or was it sufficient enough of a shock that, you know, he stopped doing it? Or perhaps he was innocent all along, because that's what the jury said. But, you know, did that girl run away from home? Was she on the streets? Did she end up with a drug habit? Is she still alive? I don't know. Our science wasn't able to help her on that day because the science wasn't far enough advanced. And that was the flag to us. You need to do something about this, because this is something that is not going to go away. It's a crime that is right across the international stage. And it's not as if this is a one-off. There are going to be many of those. And indeed, there were.
So even though the jury could identify that the guy had a unique vein pattern that was caught on this almost infrared camera, they still didn't believe her, or him, or her rather, just because she wasn't crying.
So you have to understand that nobody is in the jury room apart from the jury. Nobody knows how their discussions have gone. Nobody knows their rationale. We are not saying that the pattern is unique, because we can't. We've not done the research. All we can say is the patterns match.
Right.
There's no dissimilarities, but I don't know what that means. I do now, but I didn't then. So we couldn't say it's unique. We could only say we cannot exclude him. To go any further than that, the judge would have stopped me in his tracks, because he'd allowed the science to come in to the point at which there was sufficient information to be of value to the court, but not to mislead the court. And that's what's really important. An expert witness mustn't go beyond the boundary of where the research has moved forward to. So it was the barrister's view that she thought the reason they'd come back with a not guilty was because the jury didn't believe the girl. Now, she may have been wrong in that, but it was enough for me to say, well, we can do something about that. We can do something about the research.
Yeah, because surely you'd, I mean, if I was in the jury, you would take the fact that the man was sneaking into the room at 4:30 in the morning, there was no signs of break-in, there was video evidence, and there was repeated allegations against the father from the daughter previously that he told the mum. Did the mum end up believing her after this evidence came out?
I don't know. And that's the really dissatisfying thing about the work that we do. Mm. We parachute into a case, we provide some evidence, and then we parachute back out again. We have no involvement with the family. Because it's a not guilty plea, then a not guilty verdict, then, you know, it's an end of the case as far as, you know, any of us are concerned, police forces or otherwise.
And you think that the vein pattern that's in the hand, or, I mean, I suppose you get vein patterns everywhere, right? It'd be kind of all over the body. So that's probably a really dumb question, but I got there.
No, it's not at all. No, it's absolutely not. And I'll tell you why it's not a dumb question, is that it's really important in the back of the hand, because when you look at the particular crime of child sexual abuse, it is on a number of levels. So it's, you've downloaded images. That's a particular offence. You have shared those images with somebody else. That's another offence. Or you are the person taking those images. You're responsible for the offence. That's the highest tariff if you're found guilty. And in child sexual abuse, often we will find there is contact between the child and the perpetrator. And the most frequent form of contact is hands. So what we see is the back of the hand. Hmm. And that's why we've particularly focused on the back of the hand. You're quite right, there are other parts of the body, but most frequently it's hands that we find in those images, which is why we started with hands.
And it's almost like a fingerprint, right? Am I right in saying that, because I remember my brother had this issue where he had one of his veins was quite... it was quite prominent, and he had to get a tiny little operation, but just to sort of seal up the vein. Could vein patterns potentially change over time as you get older, or do they remain the same? Is it like a fingerprint that never really changes?
So, providing nothing happens, and that by that I mean a disease process or a surgical intervention, then the understanding is that the vein pattern doesn't change. You don't grow new veins unless you have something that is sending out signals that say you need to grow new veins. And that might be if you have cancer, a tumor development that requires a large blood supply to the tumor and then taken away from the tumor. So providing everything is normal, your vein pattern, we believe, does not change.
Okay, so it is kind of like an identifying fingerprint almost, if you were to get it on that infrared kind of camera.
Yeah, well, and you don't have to just get it on an infrared camera, because you can see the vein pattern on the back of your own hands. It's just that very first case happened to be near infrared. Most of the cases, in fact, since then, we've never had another case that's involved infrared. They're always visible light. So it's, can you see the veins? And most of the time, providing your hands aren't particularly fat, or they're not very, very hairy, or you're not covered in huge numbers of tattoos, then your veins are often quite visible.
Yeah, okay. And so what happened after that? I'm guessing after that case, was there more advances in the technology that you could use to identify these veins and more court cases that started to involve this kind of new evidence, if you could call it that?
So the trouble is, once you've done it once, then it becomes a source of conversation around people going, oh, I've got a case that could do that. And literally just a few weeks later, again, it was the Metropolitan Police. They said, we have a case of an individual where we've seized their computer and their phones. We've downloaded images on there, which are what are called first generation images. So you must bear in mind that the police look at these images. How they do it, I don't know, but they look at it all the time. And quite often you see the same image turning up in different caches of images that are downloaded onto computers or phones. But when you find a first generation image, then what that means is they've never seen that image before. And does that mean that the person who's holding the device is either responsible for the abuse, or they know somebody who is? So you've got a much closer line of contact between abuser and the abused. And so there's an urgency on the police then to get to that child as quickly as possible. Because if it's a known image, it may have been circulating around for 5-10 years. But if it's a first generation image, then there's possibly a child directly at risk now. So those are really important. And these were first generation images. And they showed the sexual abuse of young children. So we're talking about 4 or 5 years of age. And when they looked at the images, the flora and the fauna in the background suggested that this was not happening in the UK. And when they checked the individual's passport, they'd been in Thailand. and the flora and fauna in the background really linked with it being in Thailand. So the question was, is the person committing the offence? It's exactly the same question, the same as the suspect they're holding. But in this individual, we've got no vein patterns. And so we sit around the table and we have this real sort of spitballing of what else can we use? What do we know of in anatomy? Because we've shown this works with veins. What else do we know in anatomy that has so much variation that the biometrics industry also have recognized that independently? Because that partnership worked for us in the first case. Was it going to work for us in the second case? And this was an individual called Dean Lewis Hardy. So it's been out there in the press. It's very well recognized. And what we had for him was the pattern of skin creases over his knuckles. And if you look at those patterns of skin creases, they're different in every finger and they're different across both of your hands. And they're not the same in mums, dads, brothers, sisters, or identical twins. And we know the biometrics industry already looks at skin crease patterning as a means of identification. So we said, well, let's do much the same as we did in the first case. Let's look at the pattern of skin creases on the offender. And then we'll look to see, do they match on the suspect? If they don't match, it can't be them. So we're still looking at exclusion. We're not being able to say with any degree of certainty or probability that the individuals are matching. We're just being able to exclude. And yet again, what we had was all of the skin creases matched perfectly. What we also had was a scar on the left index finger. And scars, if they're accidental, occur in any number of places, the orientation of them, the size of them, the way they've healed, all of that has variability. And he had what we call the MH1R gene, which means he had freckles. Trust me, as a redhead, I know what that means. And we could actually map the pattern of his freckles because we know in the clinical literature that where freckles occur is utterly random. It's a genetic predisposition towards having them, but where your freckles are, completely random. So we had three sets of anatomical features from entirely different origins, the skin creases, the scarring, and the pigment pattern. And so we wrote the report. And when the report went to the defense, he changed his plea. And that was a real move forward because never before has someone accused of being a pedophile changed their plea on the basis of a report on their hand anatomy. And so he was found guilty and he was given a 6-year sentence, which was the maximum, I think, at that time he could get because it was first generation images. Interesting to us, one of the television programs decided they were going to do a documentary called How to Catch a Pedophile, which I thought was a really bad idea. But I was wrong in that they put it out. And a number of people came forward saying, I recognize him. He abused me when I was a child in the UK.
Oh my God.
And so other charges were brought against him and he was given a much longer sentence. So for us, it was about showing the processes and procedures of anatomically what we were doing worked. And then it was about what's the next case. And the next case viewed something entirely different again, which was in Scotland, and it was one of Scotland's largest paedophile rings. And we had the skin crease pattern on the back of the knuckle, but what we also had was an anomaly of that little half moon that you have at the base of your nail. And it was unusual. And by that time, we had started to collect images. So we had a database. And we could go back and say, we don't know what this means with the knuckle creases yet, but we can go back through our database of 500 individuals and say nobody else has this pattern. So at least we can say it's at least one in 500 is the sort of anomaly of this. And that individual was found guilty and was given a prison sentence. So for us, it was showing that combining anatomy and the biometrics industry into something that it has a real life application to a major and most heinous crime that you can imagine and is global, we knew that we're never going to be short of work.
Chisholm Hunter are the sponsors of the Into the Mind podcast. And without Chisholm Hunter, we would not be sitting here today. Honestly, if you like luxury watches or luxury diamonds, Chisholm Hunter is the place to go. Amongst the luxury watch industry at the moment, there's tons of fakes kicking around, which is a really dangerous place to be. You do not want to buy a fake watch and get conned into buying a fake watch. And that's why people normally go to authorized retailers. Now, Chisholm Hunter is an authorized retailer, and they're authorized retailers for Omega, Tudor, Vacheron Constantin, Blancpain, Breguet. The list goes on and on and on. So if you want to buy a watch safe and securely, then head to chisholmhunter.co.uk. To top that off, they're also family run and they've been going for over 165 years, which is pretty awesome. So head to chisholmhunter.co.uk for a luxury watch or your next luxury diamond. And while you're there, use the discount code CHSUB, that is CHSUB, for an exclusive discount on selected lines. That is chisholmhunter.co.uk, that is chisholmhunter.co.uk. And on that note, let's get back to the podcast. One question I was going to ask there was 6 years for first generation images. Is that not really short? I mean, from my opinion, I think it is one of the most disgusting things you can ever do as a person. It's taking full advantage of the innocence of, it's just horrible. It's unfathomable to me.
Yeah.
Is 6 years not really short? Like I would think that it should be much larger than that.
So there are set tariffs that the court works to. So, you know, did you download the images? Did you send them to somebody else? Are you holding them? Did you create them? And, you know, the judge will make the decision on the day what that's for. If you think about Richard Huckle, who was the UK's most prolific paedophile. And again, he was working out of Thailand and he had set up a business fundamentally in Thailand.
Jesus Christ.
And anybody around the world could phone into him with their credit card, pretty much order what they wanted to see happen on video, and he would allow it to occur. We looked at those images of him and the abuses, and as it turned out, he came back into the UK. The police arrested him, I think it was at Heathrow, and he was given a life sentence. So it is up to the judge to decide on the scale, you know, is it a first offence? Is it multiple offences? Is it for commercial, you know, basis? You're making money out of it fundamentally. They will ultimately decide what that case, what the tariff is for that case. And of course, you can appeal. So the accused may appeal against it and the appeal will listen as to whether the sentence was too hard, or they may be appealing, of course, that it was too lenient. But that's for the courts to decide.
Yeah, I just would. I mean, I suppose on the, it's a very horrible topic. But on the positive side, when these people are caught and helped to catch, or to be caught by what you've introduced, the way that they are treated in jail, from what I've seen and what I've heard, it's not somewhere you want to be, because it's one of those things that the people that are in jail that figure out that you were doing these horrible acts, they will really go for you. And actually, in a lot of prisons, they totally segregate the people. I don't know, have you heard anything about that, the actual segregation?
Oh, only as much as I would think anybody in the general public has heard about it. There is a general feeling that those who abuse children or the elderly are viewed as being targets. And certainly, yeah. Richard Huckle was murdered in prison.
Right.
I believe it was a sharpened toothbrush that went through his ribs and either punctured his liver or his lungs. I'm not sure which it was. And so I think they are on watch for that very reason, because they are a target in prison.
Yeah, and I was watching a program called the toughest prisons in the world. It's something along those lines. And the kind of director of it, or the presenter in it, was falsely accused, and he was in jail for 20 years and he got released. And now he was falsely accused of a murder that didn't commit. And now he's a presenter and he goes around all these tough prisons. And within one of these prisons, what they do is they're in line with the guards and with the police. So as you're coming into the prison, they'll have all your documents and they'll know exactly what you're in for.
Yeah.
And if you're in for something, anything involving child abuse or abuse of a woman, they will, you know, you're as good as dead. And in some instances that is, you know, truly, truly disturbing and disgusting, in my opinion, I mean, I'm not saying you're getting what's coming to you, but you, it's hopefully a larger deterrent, because sometimes I feel like the kind of punishment can be too lenient, like 6 years for first images, or first degree images, would you call them? That's, to me, that seems very, very lenient.
It's really hard, isn't it? You know, we can all have an opinion on it, of course, but at the end of the day, the courts will decide. For me, what's really important are those individuals who are wrongly accused. That's a real issue, you know, and if you're usually a man, but if you're a man wrongly accused of child abuse and you are convicted of it, you know, how horrendous is that? So that's why we as expert witnesses appear both for the prosecution and the defence, because at the end of the day, it's about justice. Our evidence shouldn't be any different whether we're appearing for prosecution or defence, and I've done both. But I can't think of much worse, you know, if you're a family man, to be accused of doing something like that when you haven't. And, you know, they require that justice just as much as anybody else does.
Yeah.
And, you know, our job is to make sure it's fair. And what then happens beyond there, you know, we have no control over it. We have no say over it. I certainly wouldn't think that, you know, somebody like Richard Huckle got his just desserts. It's not for me to say that. And I never would, because I'm a real pacifist in that regard. If you've done the crime, then you need to do the time. And our hope is that whilst you're in prison, you can be rehabilitated out of that, so that if you are released, you're no longer a threat. And for me, that's much more important. If you've done it, let's get you into prison where children are safe from you. Let's see if we can prevent you from doing that again. And that makes you a much safer member of society to be released.
I would agree in that, you know, if you've done the crime, you're doing the time. And I think it's just get catching these people when they do it. Do you find that any women, or is it primarily men that you see, or have you seen any women that have been involved in this kind of stuff? Or
it is predominantly men. So there's absolutely no doubt it is very much a male oriented crime. But women play their part in it as well. And there have been cases, obviously, of women who have been prosecuted for child abuse. Often what they do is they're making the children available to men. So it's women who are saying, you know, I have this daughter, this niece, this nephew, whatever. And if they are besotted with the person, they might make access available to that child. Or if you remember the case in the Little Ted's nursery, which was down on the south coast of England, it was the nursery worker taking photographs of the children's genitalia that she could then sell onto individuals who wanted to purchase them. So for women, rather than it necessarily being them involved in the sexual act, often they're doing it for different reasons. But women are involved. But
yeah,
very, very uncommon.
Yeah. I mean, I was going to ask you about have you heard of the Menendez case?
Go on.
So there was two males. There's a series on it. It's really interesting.
The murder?
Yeah, exactly. So
I don't remember much about it, but it was brothers, wasn't it? And they murdered parents.
Yeah. So essentially what happened is they came home one night and they had two shotguns, and in the most brutal fashion, they murdered their parents. And this got, obviously, eventually they got caught, because I think they spent, don't quote me, but I think they spent like £250,000 straight after the murder. So people assumed it was maybe about the inheritance, and it was about the money that they would get. But when they started going through court, it transpired that there was, you know, very strong sexual assault allegations from the father to the son. And the mum was not the instigator. She wasn't making it happen, but she knew fair well what was happening and wasn't doing anything. So it really muddied the waters between, I mean, these two people brutally murdered their parents, but also they might have been under so much psychological stress from the fact they were being sexually assaulted that they were kind of pushed into it. And it's interesting because it plays both sides of the story. And, you know, in order to do something that brutal and that lacking of humanity, something really wrong must have happened, or something really fundamentally, the kind of tectonic plate of your life must be really skewed because of something that's happened for you to do that act. But it's really, really interesting. You should definitely watch it, because it plays both sides of it. And now what's happening is the Menendez brothers, in light of new evidence and in light of the kind of Me Too movement and all these kind of things, their case is now being reviewed, and they might be released a lot earlier than they thought they would, because I think they were on life sentences.
But what's really interesting there is that there's a couple of things really interesting in that story. And I say it's not one that I know particularly intimately, but that issue of, does the abused become the abuser? And the answer is not necessarily, you know, so there is no real indication that if you've been abused as a child, you will become an abuser. But there is a lot of evidence that says if you've been abused, that trauma is with you for life. You listen to the individuals who are victims of Jimmy Savile, for example, because it happened to them 30 odd years ago, it isn't any less raw now than it was then. And what we forget is that every incident of abuse leaves that scar on somebody. And some people manage to bury it a little bit better than others, but, you know, it's never far off the surface. And so, you know, these children who are being abused, it stays with them for the rest of their life. It's a life sentence in many ways for the victim, which is why if we can take these paedophiles off the street, then maybe we've saved them abusing a few other children further down the line and you know, just being able to interact as swiftly as possible. But, you know, that issue of abuse and abusers is really an interesting one.
And it's interesting as well, because the older brother came out and said that he had actually been abusing the younger brother in the same manner that his father was abusing him. So
it's learned behavior, and it becomes learned behavior. I'm not a psychologist, but learned behavior that almost normalizes because it's what you expect. With the wife, what you've probably got is a differential in power. So she knows dad's doing it, but can she step in? Because, you know, what will dad do to her? So there may be fear for her, or if she's been abused by him, then, you know, you've got that differential in power. It is such, in many ways, I'm still convinced that abuse in many ways is not so much about sex, although that plays an important part. I think it's really about power and it's about control.
Yeah, I would agree.
It's abuse of power and abuse of control.
Yeah, I would totally agree. And I think what you said about the wife there as well, kind of, it rings true. At least in this case, it definitely rings true, because the gent, in this case, the dad, was worth millions upon millions upon millions. I think he had a key share in Hertz, the rental company, and he was going into music. Yeah. So he's worth a lot of money. So obviously she didn't maybe want to leave because of what he could provide. She knew what was going on. She swept it under the carpet. Have you, like, even talking about this kind of stuff, because I have a little sister and in the future, you know, I'd want to have children, and even talking about this kind of stuff, it enrages me. Do you have any mental fallout from dealing with these cases?
So I have three daughters and I have a granddaughter, so I'm very conscious of it. But it was a really dear policeman of mine when I started doing one of these cases, and I asked him, should I do it? And he advised me not to. He said, don't do it, because once these images are inside your head, they never go away. And you never know which one is eventually going to bite you and really sort of, you know, hurt. And of course, I didn't listen, because at the end of the day, I'm a middle-aged, red-headed Celtic woman. I'm going to do what I want to do anyway. But he said to me, the most important thing you can do is not to allow it to become personal. You did not cause this. You couldn't stop it. It's not your guilt to own. You have to just do your job as an impartial scientist. And I've always worked to that mantra. The only time I was ever conscious of my life bleeding in slightly from my professional life into my personal life, and I know she won't mind me saying it, was when my youngest daughter was probably about 12, maybe she was about 12, and it was school dance, and school dance was very much prom, so it was very proper evening dresses, and she's a skinny little rake, she really is, and her hair was up and she had this gold sequin dress on, and she looked $1 million, she really did. You know, my eyes were on stocks when she came down the stairs thinking, I want to lock you in your bedroom forever and never let anybody anywhere near you. And so we were at the dance. And so, you know, as chaperones, you were there. And I looked over and I saw her dancing with a middle-aged man. And I didn't know who he was. And I could feel my heart rate increase. Mm. I could feel my anxiety levels go up. I could feel my blood pressure rising. And my husband looked at me and said, what's wrong? And I said, who's that dancing with it? And he went, I've no idea. I watched every move that man made. I know exactly where his hands were at any point throughout that dance. And I realize I'm projecting onto her the fact that I'm concerned who this man is because of the way she looks.
Yeah.
And as soon as the dance was done, over I ran and, you know, sort of whisked her away and said, you know, who was that? And it was the father of the boy who had taken her to the dance. You know, the man did not put a finger wrong. He absolutely didn't. That was my reaction. And I was aware of it. And so what I did was the next day I sat with my team and I said, I need to tell you about a reaction I've had. And that was me allowing my professional and my personal life to bleed into each other. And so we have a really good mechanism whereby we support each other. And it allows us to teach each other to look for these different signals that come along. And I've never had it since, but that was the one episode. And of course, my daughter thought it was hysterical.
But you're right. I think the education, it allows you to see potentially sometimes what other people don't see. Like, I'm a professional video editor and I'll watch a movie with my missus and I'll say, did you see that transition there? You know, they did that transit. Or did you see that color grade there? They did that. Or did you see that?
It, because she must hate sitting watching films with you.
Despises it. But it allows you to identify, because you've been educated and because that's what I do as a living, it allows you to identify these key factors that movies do and tricks that they play and, you know, transitions and scenes. But for you, it will be, I understand that the phone that she has in her hand, that's a recipe for disaster. The social media platform that she's on, the WhatsApp group she's in, you know, there's just so many red flags that will raise in your mind that, to me, I wouldn't even think of. But because
you've been... I talked very openly with my girls all the way through, you know, and I've always said to them, have you ever been in that position where you feel someone has either abused you or been close to it? And they went, no, Mum, because you told us all the things that we had to look out for. And, you know, it's not a conversation we often want to have with not just our daughters, but our sons as well, because boys are just as likely to be abused as girls. You know, we don't have those conversations, because there was the one case that we did, which I think was Birmingham, but it might have been Manchester. So please, you know, correct me. And his name was Sanaga, and he was young men. So what he would do is he would go out. So he was a student and he would go out and he would spike somebody's drink. They would then think, oh, gosh, you know, I'm drunk. He would befriend them and say, look, you've had too much to drink. My flat's just round the corner. Come on round and just crash there. And the person would crash, literally wake up in the morning, not know what had happened, assumed that they just drunk too much. And unbeknownst to them, they were being, and you know, that it was obviously done in such a way that there was no violence, or they would have been aware of the pain associated with it. It came to light because one of the individuals that he had drugged was not fully under, and so he came around in the midst of being beat seven bells out of the chap, who then ran out of the flat, and the police were called. They arrested the man who subsequently we know was being, but that led to the incident of saying, well, no, hold on a minute, you know, this is what I woke up to. And they found at least 60 or 70 men he had done that to. Now, can you imagine the police knocking on your door and saying, we think you've been raped? And to which they say, well, I don't think so. And you're shown the video that shows, in fact, you have been. And the women you say this to say, well, this is what we have all the time. Men don't think it happens to them, but it can. And so we need to educate everybody, not just the girls and the women, but the boys and the men too.
Does it normally, I think you're right in terms of the control aspect. You know, it's about someone taking control of you and in some, you know, mentally screwed up way they think that gives them a rush and they think that that's great. Did you ever watch Baby Reindeer?
Yes, I did. Yeah.
And that's kind of the same power dynamic that was happening. You know, he was going around to this guy's flat that was I think he was a famous comedian, and he was saying, you know, I can get you all these gigs. And it was a manipulation. You know, he was just manipulating. Totally. He'd give him something good so that he came round, and then say he was shit so that he left. And then, you know, this went on and on and on. But he was doing the same thing. He was drugging him, pretty much.
It's abuse. It is abuse. Abuse of power.
Hmm. And am I right in saying that you did a stint where you were identifying victims that had fallen in Iraq?
Yes. So I did two tours in Iraq.
Right. And how did they go? What was the, is it the same?
Well, you never want to put a redhead somewhere that hot, do you? I mean, you know, so the government used to send me to all the hot places in the world, which is just, you know, hell on earth for me, let alone just stepping off the plane is horrendous. The first time we were out there, we were looking specifically for two individuals whose bodies had gone missing. And if you remember Terry Lloyd, who was the ITN reporter, he wasn't embedded within the military. So he was an independent rogue reporting team, which was not a wise thing at all. And as there was an interpreter, there was a cameraman, and then there was somebody else who I can't remember. I think there was four in the car, and they were heading across Bridge 4 into Basra. And they met the Iraqi troops coming the opposite direction. So they turned around and headed in the opposite direction to meet the Americans coming in the opposite direction. So they got caught in the crossfire. The car got taken away by the Iraqi forces. And I think when they realized Terry Lloyd was the reporter that he was, his body was released back. There was a survivor who I can't remember his name, but the cameraman was called Freddie Nerak and the interpreter was called Osman Hussein, and their bodies had never been found. And it was Freddie Nerak's wife, I believe, who pulled an amazing feat. It was at a press conference in the White House. And she had got all of the press to agree that when there was a call for questions, nobody else would put their hand up apart from her. And she put her hand up. So I think it was the president, but I'm not sure, asked the question. She said, "When are you going to bring my husband back?" And so they said, "You have my word, ma'am, we will find your husband." And so as a result, the forces that were out in Iraq were tasked with, we need to find these bodies. And there had been some suggestion that a car had been found that was burnt out, and it was very much the same kind of car that they'd had. And would we be able to find the car, and would we then be able to forensically search through the car to see if there was any evidence of the remains? And we were able to find some fragments of bone in the footwell of the car, because when the car had gone into flames, chances are what happened was that the shoes would have melted onto the floor of the car. And so when the bodies were pulled out, the lower half of the bodies remained in the car. And that's why we were able to find some of the fragments. So it was those kinds of things that we were doing, trying to identify and find people who had been listed as missing.
Did that have a mental impact on you?
This is my job.
But do you think, like, you know, everyone has, everyone chooses their career and everyone has jobs, but I think some jobs take more of a mental toll. I mean, being a policeman, especially in America, it must be terrifying, you know, and it must have a huge mental toll. Being in the military must have a huge mental toll. Being in the court of law, being a lawyer, seeing all this, especially criminal law, must have a huge amount of mental toll. Like, do you ever feel that? Do you ever feel like that kind of weight a little bit? Or is there any days, or do you just kind of segregate yourself from it totally?
So I think I've now got to a stage in my career where I've done enough. It's not that and I've backed away from doing most active cases now. And it's not because, I've reached a saturation point or anything. I've just moved on. My job was to train the teams coming behind me. And there comes a point when the old girl has to fall off the perch so that the younger teams are there to do the job. And, you know, it's a young person's job, jumping in and out of the back of a Hercules or a Chinook helicopter or going down a hole in the ground. It really isn't for old biddies like me. It really isn't. Comes a point. Well, no, that's how I feel. So there comes a point where you have to say enough. And I've done that, but it's not because I've reached a saturation point of thinking I can't cope with this mentally anymore. I think I was very lucky in my career that I was desensitized, but that doesn't make me cold, but desensitized to it along the way. And I think being an anatomist helps, because you spend your entire life with the dead. And so it takes away, first of all, that fear of the dead, because that's what your job is. And when you go into the mortuary, you have a specific task that is saying, who was this person? What happened to them? You're not involved in their world. You're in a different world, and you have a skill set that you have to bring to it. You will tell the police about that, and they will tell the court about it, and they will all do their job, but you only do your little bit. And it's that back to that piece of advice that I was given. I can't own the guilt. I didn't cause it. I couldn't stop it. I'm just a tiny cog in this big wheel. And if I don't do my job properly, then things will go wrong. But if I do more than my job, things will go wrong as well. It's not my job to be outraged. It's the public's job to be outraged. It's the government's job to be outraged. It's not my job as a scientist. My job as a scientist is to do my job.
Yeah, you're a braver woman or person than I, because I think that I would get extremely attached, and I think that I would really struggle to let things go. I mean, the story you told me at the start about this little girl that's recording this man coming into the room, if that had happened to my sister, that's just I would be in jail.
But it didn't happen to my sister. It happened to somebody I didn't know, and I couldn't have stopped it. But it was my job to look at the evidence, and if the person was guilty, help to put them away, which we didn't do in the end. So it's knowing where that boundary stops. If I become personally involved in a case, then I am not being an objective, impartial scientist, and I'm dangerous to the case.
Would you back out the case in that case? Would you say, listen, this, I'm getting too emotional here, I need out?
Yeah, I never have, but yeah. I would. Or if there was a personal reason for it, so somebody I knew or whatever it may be. No, absolutely walk away from it, because my job is not to impact on justice. Hmm. And if I can't become an advocate. That's the job of the courtroom. All they want from me is, where's the evidence? Did you recover it? Did you analyze it? What did you find? What does it mean? And I can't impact on it more than that.
But yes, because you need to remain impartial. I suppose, yeah. Is it the same as doctors where, you know, doctors, if they know somebody that's in critical care, they'll say, no, listen, I can't deal with that one. It's the same kind of thing. You say, listen, I know somebody that's involved in this case. I need to steer clear, because that emotionally brings ties into it, and then brings your prejudice into it. Right, got you. And has there ever been in any case that you've been in that's been particularly, I suppose, bizarre in its nature? Like, have you ever been in a case and you've thought, oh, I really don't even know where to go here?
Oh, gosh. Almost every case does that, because every case is different, you know. Thinking off the top of my God, there are so many. If you think about it, a woman walked into a police station and she said to the police, if you go and dig underneath this patio, you'll find a dead body. And the police go and they dig under the patio, and they do find a dead body, but it has no head.
Oh.
And what the lady had done was, she used to look after the old woman. And her story was that she came in one day and the old lady was dead. And she thought, well, I'll just bury her. So she buried her under the patio, but she carried on collecting her old age pension, even though she was dead.
My God.
And then we said, well, that's okay. We've got that, but where's the head? And the police, you know, when I said to them, yeah, I can't find the head, they went, well, where is it? You know, everybody's got a head. And you feel like, gosh, I must be a really bad forensic anthropologist, because I find a body, but I can't find the head. Where's the head? And she said, what the lady said was, she said, and it's not funny, it really isn't, but sometimes it's just so ridiculous. She said, well, I didn't feel I could bury her head, so I cut her head off and I put it in a plastic bag in the shed. And every time I've moved house, I've just taken it with me, because I've not known what to do with it. So we had to go and search the shed to find the head, and it became the head in the shed case. And you think, you know, if you wrote that in a crime novel, people would tell you you're making it up.
Yeah, that is crazy.
Bizarre. I mean, I have excavated septic tanks looking for bodies, you know, the worst place that you could imagine. Many cases that are quite bizarre, because humans are bizarre.
There was a really bizarre case recently, and I can't remember the lady's name, but she'd essentially killed her parents, and then I think she kept them in her bedroom for like years. and she was living in the house with the dead bodies. And then the police came round, eventually they figured it out. And there's video footage of her, and she's so emotionless. And she's like, oh, well, cheer up, you've caught the bad guy. And I can't remember, were you in tune with that case? I can't remember what the hell
No, I wasn't, but there was something very similar in Ireland, which was two sisters that used to live together. And one sister died, and died in bed, and the other sister slept in the bed still alongside her. The body was not found for at least a year. But that was what they always did. They always slept together, and she would talk to her, and she would make meals for her. And she would say, you know, you're not eating very much. You know, what's wrong with you? So that concept of the sibling having died just wasn't there. She died of natural causes, but that lack of an ability to let go and to realize what had happened is not uncommon.
So that wasn't a criminal charge then, I'm guessing, because
not at all. Not at all. I mean, it was a really poor soul.
It's just that's grief, right?
Yeah, it's grief. It's a mental health issue. It's just not being able to understand what it is that's happened.
Do you see any differences in the brains of these? You know, whether it's a paedophile, you know, whether it's a murderer, whether it's a hugely, a large caliber of criminal. Do you see differences in the brain at all in terms of like what? You know, I've heard a couple of times that they have a distorted frontal lobe, and that means they can't feel the emotions, so it encourages them to do that. Is that factual, or is that?
So now what you're going to get from me is the classic courtroom response, which is, that's not my area of expertise. And that's what I would say in court, to say, that's the end of that questioning, moving on.
Yeah.
Because I'm not a neurologist. I'm not a neuropathologist. I don't do the postmortems to try to establish anything other than identity. So, I mean, there's a lot of literature out there about it, but as to the reality of it, I really don't know.
Yeah, yeah. So you study more of the...
My job is about identity. Who was that person when they were alive, more than anything? And sometimes it's about being able to piece together the manner of their death, which will help the pathologist to be able to determine what was the manner and the cause of death. Because we as scientists cannot give a cause of death. That can only happen by the medically qualified pathologist. But we will effectively be able to say, well, I think this is the gunshot entry. I think this is the gunshot exit. And they'll look at it and go, yeah, I think you're right, which tells us it's a through and through execution shot type thing. And if the skull is in 100 pieces, my job is to sit and piece them back together again to be able to see where that entry and that exit wound is.
What was it like when you first started going into these court cases? Because I'm guessing like things have changed now, but especially, I'm going to say, 20 years ago, it was more of a male-dominated thing. I think courtrooms were more male-dominated. There was more lawyers that were male-dominated. Like, did you ever feel like it was male-dominated when you were walking in there? Was there ever a sense that you were maybe at unease that it was predominantly a male-dominated industry? Or did you always feel like this is what you wanted to do?
So my father was an ex-regimental sergeant major. A very typical Scotsman of his era. And my mother was a very typical Scotswoman of her era. So my father did man's things and my mother did, you know, women's things. And my father was really enlightened because he never told me I was a girl. And what I mean by that is he expected me to sit at the back door and skin rabbits with him. He expected me to help him French polish a dining table. But he also expected me to be in the kitchen helping my mother bake a rhubarb crumble. So that I never grew up with that concept of I was a girl and that there were things that girls were supposed to do. Because neither my mother or my father ever dealt with my sister or I any differently. We were expected to be able to do everything. So when I first started working with the police, if there was any form of discrimination, I was so totally oblivious to it that I would just ignore it in many ways. But what I could also do, and I learned very quickly, is to turn it to your advantage. So I can remember very early on in my career where there was a body that had gone missing. It was an alleged murder. The body had, we were told, had been cut into a number of pieces, so dismembered, and distributed in bins around the city. so that it would go to different landfill sites. And so the police were searching landfill sites. So they were coming out with all sorts of things that you could imagine. And the pathologist was getting really fed up of another bag of bones coming in from another landfill site, that he said, let's get the girl down from anatomy. So I was the girl who got brought down from anatomy. And the first policeman that I met there was a really miserable sergeant. I mean, he really was old fashioned miserable. And he looked me up and down, and you could see in his mind, he was thinking, slip of a girl, what the heck does she know? And because I'd spent my teenage years working in a butcher shop with the public, I knew how to handle the public. So I thought, whatever I say, he's not going to believe me. So what I did was I took the bones that he'd given me and I put them in a plastic bag and I popped them on the radiator while I went away and made him a cup of tea, which is what he expected me to do because that was the girl's job. And I brought him back his cup of tea and I opened up the bag and I popped it under his nose and I said, what can you smell? And he said, well, that smells like roast lamb. I said, well done. Actually, these are sheep bones. They're not human. And because he'd solved it, not the girl, he thought, oh, she's okay. And by the time we'd finished that case, we were on fantastic form between us. And he agreed that he'd handled me pretty badly in the sort of outset. But, you know, we've got ways of turning people around to the way that we want to think. I had it in Kosovo. I arrived in Kosovo and we had a head of our team who was very much an alpha dominant male police officer. And we also had a French military head personnel who was equally alpha male, testosterone dominant. These two men hated each other. It was like rutting season. There was no way they were going to give each other half an inch of space because they hated each other. And it was important because one was leading our team and the other was leading the security for our team. And so I arrived in Tours that particular time and I could feel the tension in at the site that we were at. And give the French military gentleman his due, he walked over to our head of team and he put out his hand to shake his hand. And I thought, great, we've had movement. My head of team looked at it, shook his head and thought, I don't think so, and turned and walked away. And I thought, why would you do that? Why would you create that level of aggression? So the military gentleman came over to me and he held out his hand to shake my hand. And I went, no, I don't think so. And you could see him think, oh, great, another Brit who's going to be intransigent. And I said, because I thought you were a Frenchman. He said, well, I am. I said, but I thought a Frenchman greeted each woman with a kiss on both cheeks. And he just melted. And so I got a kiss on both cheeks, which meant I could liaise with the military commander and I could liaise with my head of team. And they didn't have to give in one way to each other. And we solved the problem. By the time we walked away from Kosovo, those two men were the best friends. But we had to get there. So sometimes there are things that we can do that can just diffuse these situations.
Yeah, yeah. Isn't it crazy? Like my mum talks about this and my dad talks about this back in the day, that there was such just discrimination, just blatant discrimination against women. And it's like, it's, you know, to think of that nowadays, what the hell were we thinking?
Yeah. I've never felt discriminated against either by the police or in the courts. They treat me, as far as I'm concerned, either if they've tried to discriminate me, I'm so bullish I've never noticed it, or you know, I just won't tolerate it. It's as simple as that. The military, for example, in one of our sites in Kosovo, I have a morbid fear of rodents, mice and rats. It's just pathetic, and the military knew that. And so what they would do for me every morning, God bless them, is they'd go into the mortuary and make a huge noise to scare all the rats away. And then they'd say, right, in you go. You know, so they were aware of me and they were very almost paternalistic towards me, but they never, ever made me feel that, you know, I was looked down upon for it. I've always found it to be an incredibly equal place.
Yeah, and I think that's exactly how it should be. And I think, have you ever seen any, and again, this is maybe getting away from your expertise, but it would be interesting to know your kind of view on this. You know, you get cases, court cases that Everybody knows the guy, O.J. Simpson's perfect example. I mean, he was proven innocent, but the odds are that he was guilty. Is there ever any cases that you walk away from and you think, I mean, obviously there was that one with the little girl, but you ever think that's not right? Something's happened here. Like, is there a, I know that within politics, I was listening to this podcast with Boris Johnson the other day, and he was saying, oh, well, you know, I was offered a job if I put this policy in place, and it's just corrupt. And I'm thinking, does the court work the same way? Is it kind of like, listen, if you get this guy off or give him a lesser sentence, you'll get X? Or like, can you see it working that way?
No, I think if you want a really good example of that, the book that's just come out very recently, which is called Lucy Let Be Unmasked, I think it is, written by two journalists. What a brilliant piece of journalism, because they are showing both sides of an argument, and you can see by the end of the book, they don't know whether she's innocent or she's guilty. Mm-hmm. And in many ways, you know, the jury have decided and that's the end of it. But there's so much else around the case that just doesn't stack up. And that's a really good book to go and read if you haven't. I was really impressed with that, I have to say. We stay out of it because that's not our job. The honest truth is what the court does is for the court to decide. And if there's been a miscarriage of justice or a retrial is required, then there will be reasons for it. What's really interesting about the Lucy Letby case is that there's such a swell of external voices coming into it, whether they be other expert witnesses who weren't involved in the case or the public who have a view. I think that's going to be one to watch. And it's not necessarily about her guilt or innocence. It's about the process in the courtroom. And sometimes that process in the courtroom is really alien to a lot of people. They just don't understand what on earth is going on. That's because the courtroom is the home for lawyers. It's their game. It's their ball. It's their rules, and the rest of us just have to fit into it. Sometimes it just doesn't seem to make any sense, but it is the law.
Do you think that the external media, just from your point of view, do you think the external media, social media, the news, do you think that impacts a case? Like, I look at the Menendez case, and while that was ongoing, there was so much publicity about it that could potentially sway your opinion. You know, if you were being reinforced on Instagram and TikTok and Facebook, this guy is not guilty because X, Y, and Z, you might go in there with a different opinion and you'd still have a prejudice before you've actually seen the case.
Perfectly true. And it's one thing that the judge will always direct the jury on when they're being sworn in is to say, you will come with ideas. You need to leave them at the door. You need to not be on social media. You need not to be researching this case while you're on the jury. You can only go on the evidence that you will hear in this room. And if I find you are sharing things on social media, I will charge you with perjury. So, you know, the jury are very, very heavily schooled on what their job is and what they're allowed to do and what they're not allowed to do. Now, that's all well and good, but human nature being human nature, you know, people will have gone in with a preconception. People already will have ideas based on their own experience, because none of us come to the courtroom as a blank sheet of paper. We all come with our prejudices. We all come with our opinions. And it's a really, really difficult job to be a member of the jury, but they are the most important people in the courtroom. And we need to remember that they are lay members of the public. And so they will be influenced by lots of things, and they won't understand what is going on in the courtroom in a legal sense. And we, as expert witnesses, our job is to try and help them understand in a scientific sense. But we ask an inordinate task of those members of the public. And the vast, vast majority of them take it incredibly seriously, because it's not like the television. And the minute you're in the courtroom and you can see the accused and you can see the victim's families, you can feel the weight that settles on the jury's shoulders, thinking, I'm going to make a decision on whether this person walks out of this courtroom to their family life, or they go downstairs and into a cell for the rest of their life. And in some parts of the world, the decision they're making will actually result in a loss of life. That's a huge burden on the jury.
I think it absolutely is. And I think that it'd be an extremely difficult decision to make. I think that it's a lot easier now to generate an opinion without knowing all the facts due to social media. You know, you hear something, this guy must be guilty because he did X, but you don't see the facts behind it. You know, if I'd heard about the Menendez case and all I heard was they shotgunned their mum and dad, I'd think, fucking hell, get them in jail. But then you read it more into it, the sexual assault allegations, you see the actual court case where the guy is clearly having a mental breakdown because he can't bring himself to talk about his dad because of what he's done. There's so much more to it than the people in social media see. And I think you get this a lot in politics now as well. It's so like manufactured, and there's people there saying you can't talk about this and you need to talk about this and you're going to trim this out and you're going to edit that and then you're going to, you know, and there's so much misinformation that everything just gets really corrosive. And then let's say you've got the left and the right, they can't really come together and have a discussion about it because they're so polarized and there's so much more like kind of hate on each side. I think social media is probably like a net negative for society in that way.
Oh, I have no social media at all. So I don't do anything. You know, I don't do Facebook. I don't do whatever Twitter's called these days or any of that. The only thing I have is WhatsApp that allows me to talk to my girls. Mm. And part of that is because I know that as an expert witness, one of the things that they will do, the opposing counsel, is they'll go away and they'll troll for me online. What can they find about you online that will cast some doubt on your credibility as an expert witness? So for me, that's the perfect excuse not to do any form of social media at all. But I watch it with my grandson and my granddaughter. You know, they're permanently on their phone. They're always worried about who's liking what they're doing and who's not. And the pressures on them are huge. And, you know, you think about these algorithms where, you know, if you had suicidal ideology in any way, suddenly what you do is you get bombarded with all of these that reinforces the negativity rather than any positivity. Well, it's dreadful.
It's a mirrored room effect. And I think that's what happens especially in America. I think it's particularly bad. But let's say you thought the earth was flat or, you know, something like that, a bit wacky. It would be reinforced to you through the algorithm that the earth was flat. And then
that you're right. You're absolutely right. Everybody else is wrong. You're right.
Exactly. And that becomes really dangerous because I feel like conversations like these, like we're having right now, an hour, 2 hours, 3 hours, whatever it is, that should be the way to have a discussion. You know, sit in a room, you know, this is my point, this is your point. Let's have a discussion about it. Let's try and come to common ground. But because I honestly think it's to do with social media. I think it's so polarizing that we now can't even sit in a room with each other because we'd rather type online how we feel and not actually listen to the other side.
But the anonymity of typing online as well, that you feel you can say whatever you like, which you would never do in a room to somebody's face, but you feel you have that impunity to be able to say, well, I can say anything that I want. That's really dangerous. That takes away the social norms that we expect of a polite interaction where you respect the other person. I love the idea that somebody has a completely different viewpoint to me, that I have the confidence to be able to sit back and listen and think, actually, you're right. I was wrong. And somebody can change my way of thinking. I think that's a wonderful day when that happens. But it doesn't happen online.
Oh, it never happens online. With your daughters, do you tailor that in any way? Do you like give them time limits on their phone, or do you?
Well, given that my oldest daughter is 40, if I gave her time limits on anything, can I just say I know exactly what she'd say to me? She's the one that has my two grandchildren,
right?
And she does. She monitors very closely how long they're online, who they're online with, what sort of things that they do. But it's a constant worry for her. And my other two daughters act almost as that sort of buffer. So they'll watch online to see if the grandchildren are doing anything that they shouldn't be, and they'll inform mum. Mm. You know, so there's a little safety net around them because we're all very aware of how dangerous a place this, you know, virtual world can be. We worry about the real world and the dangers in the real world, actually, the dangers in the virtual world, because of what it does to your mind, I think is really, really concerning.
I would agree. I think when you go out I remember being 16, 17, and I would go out to a party. And when you're 16, 17, you're an idiot. You're a fetus. You have no idea what the world is. You do stupid shit and then you learn from it. But yeah. Now you do stupid shit. You've been caught on camera and it follows you around for the rest of your life on social media.
Absolutely. That digital footprint never goes away. So by and large, you know, if we did something silly, someone may have taken a photograph of it. That I mean, I'm so much older than you. That photograph would have been taken to Boots the Chemist or some other company, you know, to be developed. So you never put anything on photographs that Boots wouldn't develop. And only one person ever had that photograph of you that was incriminating in any way. So the chances of it being lost forever is incredibly, you know, it's infinitesimal. Nowadays, anything that's online is there almost forever and can be trolled forever. So you're never allowed to forget your mistakes. People will always bring them up to you and you never escape from it. And as you say, when you're young and you don't really know what you're getting into, you're maybe following people who are, you know, not necessarily the best influence on you, then you can find yourself in a really difficult situation that you can't get out of.
Yeah. And I find it really sad. Like I see some cases of, you know, famous people, YouTubers that are obviously, a lot of them are a lot younger, and somebody goes through their, Twitter and finds a comment from when they were 13 years old and they say, he's racist. And you think, well, the guy, like he's probably heard something on a movie and he's probably just repeated it because I know for a fact, like I was so easily influenced and easily led when I was, you know, 13 all the way up to 18. It's only at really 21, 22, 23 when you start thinking, oh shit, right, okay, I'm not going to do that because that has consequences. You know, the risk-taking element of being young is a superpower, but it's also, it can be really dangerous, especially in the online world because it's never going to go away.
No, never going to go away. My youngest daughter was born aged 40. And so she very much became the sensible parent to her older sister, her next sister up in many ways. And I was the same. I was always born old. And, you know, we're the sensible ones who don't do that. And we're always there to make sure that those who go and do the things they shouldn't do have got the safety net. So you need those boring people like me and my youngest daughter to be there for you, to allow you to go and make those mistakes safely.
Yeah, exactly. And then identify them, have a chat with you. Have you ever been in a case where social media has been an influence that you've like felt it within the courtroom, where you've seen it's been big enough that social media has had a part to play in it?
No, not that I'm aware of. The only thing that I have, just in a sort of funny sense, is because I did a television series quite some years ago called History Cold Case. I was giving evidence in the west coast of Scotland and I stood up to give evidence and the judge said, "Now, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, I know you will have seen the witness on television last night. That's not who is here today. She's here as an expert witness." And I thought, oh, my goodness me, I'd never thought that television program could have had an influence. And I stopped doing television work at that point because it was more important for me to be in the courtroom than it was to be thought of as being somebody who's on the television, which I just really wouldn't want to do. I love radio. I love talking, but I don't want to be in front of a camera.
Yeah, for sure. Oh, it's scary as well because I do a lot of YouTube work and I've been stopped in the street of Glasgow and stopped in London and people get, they're normally amazing. Don't get me wrong. Like they're normally want to say hi. But also you're thinking like they kind of feel like they know you.
Yes.
Or they don't. And it's like, well, it's this really weird medium where you're kind of like saying hi to someone that you've never met before. You know it's normally 99% of the time they're lovely, but what you fear is that somebody not so nice knows your name and then figures out.
Absolutely.
You know,
so we did two series of History Cold Case and people would just come and sit down next to you on the train and talk to you about, you know, whatever episode it was. And they'd say things like, you know, when you said you were heading south across the Tay Road Bridge, you weren't, you were heading north, you know, and you think, sorry, but you know, I'm not the editor. So that kind of thing used to happen all the time. And the other one was when I was down at that same court case on the west coast of Scotland, I was checking into a hotel and there was a woman in front of me at the reception and she turned around, she did that thing, you know, people do that with their eyes closed thinking, I know you from somewhere, you know, and she said, I know you from somewhere. I said, oh, I don't think it's likely. She said, no, I do. I know you from somewhere. And then she obviously had a flash of inspiration. Oh, I know, she said, you work in Matalan. And so I spent about 5 minutes talking to this lovely lady as if I was somebody who worked in the big pants section of Matalan. And at some point or another, she's going to see me again on camera and think, oh, that wifey from Matalan did awfully good for herself, didn't she? But yeah, it was a bit of nonsense, I'm afraid. But yeah.
And it's scary what people like notice, though, like as you said there, yeah. Oh, well, you were actually going south, you weren't going north, yeah. Or you were going north, you weren't going south. Like people,
everyone's a critic.
Oh, everybody. And I had a guy come up to me, lovely guy, by the way, he just wanted to talk about watches, which is what I do, yeah. Aside from this. And he said, oh, I was watching your video the other day. I know exactly where you live. And I was like, shit. I was like,
that's worrying.
That's worrying. I was like, how the hell did you, because I'm really nervous about that. Like I cover things up. Oh, well, I saw your car, you know, a car registration plate. And then I walked past that car and realized it was, and I was like, holy shit. That is like,
yeah, that's worrying.
That's worrying. That's
a different
scary.
Level. Yeah. It's a different level.
And kids aren't aware of that. Like they'll post things online of their street or of them playing outside the house. And they don't realize that somebody predatory could look at that and think, I know exactly where you live.
Yes. So my big advice that I always give to anyone who has a child in the family is that if they have a camera on their computer, put a post-it across it, because people can hack into the camera and they will watch you in your bedroom.
Oh my God.
They will know if there's somebody in the house because they can hack into your camera. So stick a post-it note over when the camera's not being used, stick a post-it note over it.
That is terrifying. I think I have heard that before. I think Apple, I've heard this quite incredible story actually about Apple. They will give a hacker £1 million if they can hack into an Apple product. And by doing this repeatedly over the years, through the years that Apple have been where they are, they've actually engineered a really, I mean, it's never going to be 100%, but they've actually, you know, got rid of all the bugs. Whereas I think Windows, from what I heard, you're absolutely correct. I think Windows are the bad ones, like the bad computers.
I wouldn't know. I'm so computer illiterate. It's just advice I give to everyone, because, you know, you can never have too much advice if it's got a little bit of safety attached to it.
Whereabouts were you from in Scotland?
So I was born in Inverness.
Right.
And then I was brought up, we moved to the West Coast when I was six, and a place called Strome, which is on Loch Carron. And so it was the most idyllic rural upbringing you could imagine. You know, there were what must have been maybe 12 pupils in my primary school, the entire primary school. So, you know, it was a very, very small school and we all knew each other. So we were all a gang. So, you know, in the mornings you'd get thrown out after breakfast and we'd all congregate and off we'd go, you know, doing nothing that we shouldn't do. But, you know, you had the shore down by the loch, or you were up into the hills or whatever. And then some poor mother would get all of us descending on them at lunchtime. And then you'd come home at supper time exhausted and your parents didn't know where you'd been. But you'd not been at risk and you'd not done anything that you shouldn't. It was quite incredible. So I really am a West Coaster at heart.
So am I, 100%. I'm staying in Glasgow at the moment, but I love the islands. I love going up to Skye. I love going down to, away to Perth. Love Harris, Lewis. Like, I love just the kind of tranquility and silence of Scotland is so beautiful. Like, it's undeniable, and the harshness of the weather coming in, the kind of cozying up with a fire, it's just such a beautiful way of living. Do you miss that now that you're
totally and I won't be down here for long, so you know, I'm enjoying this role. It's a very, very different one for me, but and part of that was about testing whether I could do something different. But my heart belongs north of the border. So as soon as I'm ready, you know, those toes are going to be climbing over Hadrian's Wall. And if I can, then, you know, my heart belongs in the West. And I used to sing in the Gaelic mods, and I would love to get back to being able to think in Gaelic again. But that's a long way away.
So can you speak Gaelic? Can you kind of read Gaelic or speak it?
I could. So my father's aunt always made a point of only ever speaking to me in Gaelic.
Right.
And she refused to speak to me in English, so that she forced me in many ways. And I have to say, I mean, I lost it pretty much as a young teenager, if not before. And so it's not ingrained in me. So I can understand more than I have the confidence to speak these days. Yeah. So I'm hoping it will come back.
It's very sad that it's a dying language, isn't it?
Yeah. I think it's a beautiful language. It's just got such musicality. It just rolls, you know, and you listen to it when it's spoken by a native. And by that, I mean, whether they're, you know, a Hera from Harris or they're Luasach or a Skianach or whatever it may be, there's a lilt, there's a real music lilt that my accent, which, you know, is Inverness as much as anything, just will never have that softness and that lilt to it. So my Gaelic was always probably a hard-edged Gaelic, but there's just rolls. It's beautiful.
Yeah, I think it's amazing in Scotland, just like the soul of the place. I've been very, very lucky that I've been able to travel, and there's tons of places that have huge amounts of culture. Indonesia, for one, is incredible. But there's just something about the culture in Scotland, the kind of the soul of the place. It's something that you can't describe. And my sister went to Dubai, and I was thinking, I don't really know. I feel like that's soulless.
Yeah. Alex Salmond did it well, God bless him. You know, he when he had the Coming Home, if you remember the Coming Home program that he had, that's what works, because with Scotland, you feel you're coming home. Mm. And it's that sense of belonging. It's that sense of a deepness, a soul, a heart. It's there. It's definitely, there's nowhere else in the world I would rather be. And if you think in Scotland, where would I want to be? It's always West Coast.
Oh, it's just stunning. It's beautiful. Have you done the North Coast 500?
No, and I haven't, and I probably won't. And the reason that I probably won't is that I hear so many rumours from people that it's just chock-a-block caravans and bikes and such things that I'd probably get inordinately frustrated by it. I think it's great for tourism, but I do worry that, you know, maybe it's just a bit much. For what is a really quiet and rural country, by and large.
Exactly. And you know, when you're traveling around Scotland, at least when I'm traveling around Scotland, that's what you want, right? You want the ruralness, you want the quietness, you want nobody else there, and you want to be in your own thoughts and listen to music or podcasts, whatever you want to do. The North Coast 500, it's funny, as soon as you put like a name on something, like the Iceland did it, they did the Golden Circle, which is essentially like the Ring of Iceland.
Yeah.
It doesn't decimate it. It's brilliant for tourism, but in terms of the locals there, they hate it because it's just floods and floods and floods of people. And actually, it's funny. So we did the North Coast 500, my ex-girlfriend and I, and after it, we were thinking, right, you know, we're never going to do that again. But what we will do is, why don't we just take a road on the inside? So you've got the kind of rings, you've got the ring road. Why don't we just take a road on the inside and then stop? Yeah. And we kind of broke up, but I did it. And so nobody there. It was as if you're in Scotland again, but just because it has a name and a marketing campaign around it makes it that popular.
So, you know, I've still got some family in Kishorne and in Lough Carron, and they'd say, oh, do you want to come up? And I go, not during July and August, thanks, no. Because, you know, you won't get anywhere. You know, if you plan going up the Bialach na Ba, then it's just like the M25. Yeah. It's like a car park. And, you know, everywhere is caravans and caravanettes and such things. I think, no, I just don't want to do that.
It kills the reason that you're doing it. I think, have you ever been to Skye?
Oh, yes. I was brought up in Strome, so I know Skye well.
You're close to it. Yeah, so it's Skye, stunning, in summer, fucking nightmare. Like,
oh, it's awful. It's absolutely. I mean, Portree, I'm sorry. Portree, I'm sure it's a lovely place, but it hasn't changed since 1972. No. And you know, it's not looking its best, is it? But it's just chock-a-block with people that makes it worse.
Yeah.
I don't want to go there. But then you just go out into the you know, sort of hinterland, and it's just amazing. Just incredible.
Yeah.
Stay away from where the tourists are. That's what it amounts to.
Exactly. And as a photographer and videographer, that's what
That makes sense.
We want away from the tourist, like, you know, that's what we do. We normally just rent a car and do our own thing. Skye, if you go in the winter, it's just, although the weather is that little bit more shit and, you know, it's winter in Scotland, it's so much nicer.
So beautiful.
Nobody there.
No. My father built some of the display cabinets in Ellendonan Castle in Dorney.
Really?
And when we were up just doing a sort of holiday trip one day, I said, oh, come on, we'll go along to Ellendon and we'll see, you know, the cases that Grandad had built. There were something like 14 buses outside and we went, no, keep going, we're not going in. And I thought, no, can't cope with that.
Yeah, it's too much. But again, that's probably influenced a lot by social media. Because I remember there was a so I went quite viral when I was a little bit younger. I was maybe 20. I went up to Glencoe and I had this video of one of the majestic stags that walks around Glencoe. And I posted it on, you know, young me kind of posted it on TikTok and posted it on Instagram and et cetera, et cetera. All of a sudden, millions and millions and millions of people were viewing this. And I thought, oh my God, this is, you know, it was great for me. But then I thought, shit.
What have I done?
And then all of a sudden it became a trend. And everybody went to King's House Hotel to get the same video of the same stag. And I was like, oh my God, I've just ruined this really tranquil, beautiful place. I've sent millions of people there because of this freaking video. And I was like, why did I do that? So now when I do photography, when I do video and when it's a private spot, I never tag the location. I'll never say anything to people about the location. I keep it, you know, between me and my friends and who I want to tell, because it kills a spot, doesn't it?
Well, it's a huge responsibility, isn't it?
Yeah.
You never expected to be responsible for. You know, you're doing something that was a beautiful thing that you wanted to share with people, and then it just gets twisted into this thing that now everybody wants to see. And, oh, no, I need to be a hermit.
They also want to see it for the wrong reasons. Like, they want to go and get the video just so people on social media can see that they have the video. Whereas,
I don't get that. I am too old to get this psychology associated with social media. To me, it's just so utterly pointless that I am just not a target for these things at all. I've definitely become old and grumpy.
I do it for I've got a big wall here and a wall there and just put photos up and that's kind of what I like to do, but I never thought in a million years it would destroy the place.
Single-handedly, well done.
I think that I've kind of quizzed you enough. Where can people find you if they want to find you? Do you have a website? I know that you don't have social media.
Oh, God, no. Didn't I just say to you, I don't do social media?
No website at all?
No.
Right.
I am under everybody's radar. It's the best place to be.